Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extraordinarily scathing editorial from the centrist national newspaper, USA Today, that asks, "Will Trump's lows ever hit rock bottom?" Then goes on to say, "A president who would all but call Senator Kirsten Gillibrand a whore is not fit to clean toilets in the Barack Obama Presidential Library or shine the shoes of George W. Bush." Jennifer Machia, a professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, joins us to discuss how Trump has broken the mold of traditional presidential decorum. And to quote the editorial, "If recent history is a guide, the unique awfulness of the Trump era in U.S. politics is only going to get worse because of Trump's utter lack of morals, ethics, and simple humanity. We'll assess whether, just as the people in Alabama grew tired of Roy Moore's antics and the baggage of sexual assault accompanying him, the American people may well tire of the daily embarrassment the vulgarian in the White House brings to the office of the presidency." Then, following an election victory in Alabama that many see as a repudiation of Donald Trump and Steve Bannon, we'll explore whether the political tide is turning in America and the bad guys are no longer winning, as the good women in particular make a stand, with a good guy like Doug Jones elected to the U.S. Senate instead of a fire and brimstone theocrat and child molester. Rui Teixeira, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of a new book, The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think, joins us to discuss the beginning of what he sees as a revival of the American left, galvanized in opposition to Trump and mobilized to vote for change. Then finally, we will speak with Mark Sandelow, the editor-in-chief of the California News Service, who spent 21 years with the San Francisco Chronicle, including 11 years as the paper's Washington bureau chief. We will analyze whether the punishment of California in the Republican tax bill and the double standard of relief for hurricane victims in Florida and Texas, but not for fire victims in California, will backfire on California's Republican delegation in the 2018 election, since 11 of the 14 voted for the tax bill. And joining us now is Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a third book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Machia.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And Jennifer, you've certainly got some grist for the mill talking about presidential rhetoric. I am absolutely astounded by the editorial in USA Today, which is a pretty centrist newspaper. I think it's the biggest circulating newspaper in the United States. I've never seen any newspaper, let alone one that's not necessarily on the left at all, for that matter, come out with such searing denunciation of this president. How did it strike you?
Yeah, absolutely. It does read sort of odd, actually. It's a barn burner, and I think it is out of character for them. I think of them as sort of, like you say, centrist. They're in all the hotels. You know, it's sort of the paper of record for the business community in that way. It was a very emotional, emotion-laden op-ed from them. I was surprised myself.
Well, just it starts out, "A president who would all but call Senator Kirsten Gillibrand a whore is not fit to clean the toilets in Barack Obama's presidential library or shine the shoes of George W. Bush." then it gets nastier from there on. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And so is this a reflection, given the sort of centrist or center-right nature of USA Today as kind of America's newspaper, do you think that the country is tiring of the antics of this kind of vulgarian in the White House? Because I always understood, since we don't have royalty like they do in the UK and other countries, our head of state is both the political leader and the head of state. And there's a certain expectation with the head of state to conduct the office with dignity befitting a great power like the United States. And this guy is flunking badly.
Absolutely. I think that it does represent both a frustration with Trump as the president, but also a sort of frustration with this year of continuous distraction and just being on edge. Everyone has been so obsessed with Donald Trump and what he's going to say. And it does sort of feel like this op-ed from USA Today is a kind of unleashing of this emotional energy that we all have, where we're just tired of this guy. We're tired of paying attention to him and the things that he says and the way that he embarrasses himself and the nation. And yeah, it does seem as though USA Today wanted to express their frustration.
So going back to the tweet from Donald Trump in response to Senator Kirsten Gillibrand calling for his resignation because of the, I think 19 women have come out and said that they were either sexually harassed or sexually assaulted by Donald Trump. And the idea that he, you know, attacked her in the way that he did, and he called her a flunky and then said that she'd come to my office begging for campaign contributions not so long ago and would do anything for them. That's pretty unambiguous, isn't it? I mean, that's more or less saying she's prostituting herself in front of me and would do anything if I gave her money. I don't know how else she could see that, but believe it or not, the White House spokesman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, saw it very differently. And she said anybody who thought that Donald Trump was implying that Kirsten Gillibrand was a whore, their minds are in the gutter. So that's the surreal part of it, isn't it? You've got, on the one hand, you've got this out-of-control vulgarian just spouting off all kinds of horrible, hateful things on a regular basis. And then you've got these people that speak for the United States on the taxpayer's dime, basically saying, no, what you saw is not what happened. This is what happened. We're into some pretty surreal territory here in the United States in terms of the truth being a moving target.
Right. And Trump will always take advantage of ambiguity in any opportunity that he has to mislead or misstate or lead you in a direction, but then be able to credibly claim that that's not the right interpretation or not what he meant. He's always going to do that. That's the way he talks. So his classic technique for doing that, the rhetorical term, is paralipses. And that's when he says, and I think he did it today, you know, I'm not saying, I'm just saying. So he said today something about, you know, he said the media. And he said, I didn't call him fake news. Did you hear me? I didn't call him fake news. Right. So he calls him fake news by not calling him fake news. But so what he did with the senator is the same sort of thing. Right. So one interpretation and sort of standard reading would be, well, you know, I've been saying that politicians are corrupt all along and she's just another one of those corrupt politicians. And then the other, of course, obvious interpretation is the one that is much more maligned and malicious towards her, right, which is to say that she was trading sexual favors for campaign donations. You can't prove it either way, right? And that's one of Trump's sort of brilliant strategies, is you can't hold him accountable for his words because you can't really prove what his intent was.
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communications and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a third book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. So I think the most pernicious part of it, apart from this peculiar alternative reality that 35% of the country are in, this sort of bubble that's created largely by, I think, the number one Trump whisperer, I understand, is Rupert Murdoch, who talks to him almost every day. And he's clearly orchestrating a campaign now to try and get the special prosecutor fired by having his sort of propagandists on Fox say the most outrageous things about Robert Mueller. So that's going on. He's already secured that kind of bubble where 35% of the American people are immune to facts and evidence. But where I find it really even more corrosive is that these dictators abroad, like Erdogan in Turkey and the dictator or the would-be dictator in Venezuela and across the globe, Duterte, Hun Sen in Cambodia, are all borrowing from Trump's rhetoric and accusing any criticism of them as fake news. So I think that he's doing more damage to the world, you know, or as much damage to the world as he is doing to the United States.
That's right. And he provides people who have a sort of authoritarian leadership style, he provides them with a credible, plausible deniability, right? He allows them to deny, what is accurate reporting about the things that they do that are against the will of their people. It's not a good situation. It's not a good situation for us or worldwide, absolutely. And this is one of the things I'm writing about in my book about demagoguery. You know, there's a way of thinking about a demagogue as being a leader of the people, and so that's a good thing. You would want someone to emerge who leads the people. But at the same time, you wouldn't want an unaccountable leader. And so what I'm writing about is the way that Trump can be seen by 35% as, you know, the one who's speaking the truth and fighting for them against the corrupt other parts of the state. And what he is to everyone else is someone who's an unaccountable leader who refuses to be held accountable for his actions, his campaign promises, or whatever. And so it really is a sort of dangerous situation where you have, you know, these sort of dual meanings of this leader, and they're absolutely at odds, and he's able to play those sides off of each other, you know, with himself in the middle as the referent.
Well, just to go back to the USA Today editorial, Donald Trump, the man, on the other hand, is uniquely awful. His sickening behavior is corrosive to the enterprise of a shared governance based on common values and the consent of the governed. So this editorial, of course, coincides with the Republicans' loss in Alabama. Now, I know the Democrats are emboldened, and a lot of people who are appalled by Trump finally feel that the tide is turning, that maybe the bad guys are going to stop winning, and the bad guys have been winning all around the world. In many ways, it seems like the good women are stepping up. So how do you see this change, if indeed you are one who is optimistic?
Yeah, I think it's hard to draw any conclusions from the Alabama Senate race from last night. I think that the margin of victory was the margin of the write-in people who wrote in other candidates. And so I don't know that it was that there was a strong Democratic, you know, party win. So much as it was a truly bad candidate for the Republican Party. So I want to be optimistic and say that the good guys are going to win in the end, whoever, you know, the good guys are. But I don't know if you can draw that conclusion from what we saw happen last night. I think that based on who was running, that the Democrats probably should have won that race. I think it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out. You know, I mean, one of the problems with an unaccountable leader is even if, you know, the Mueller investigation decides to indict Trump, you know, an unaccountable leader is a person who won't stand for that. So he'll figure out some way to circumvent that kind of retribution or being held accountable. I don't know exactly what that would be, because I'm not Trump, but I'm sure he's got a plan for it. He'll do anything, it seems like, to really keep our attention, you know, and to distract us from the things that maybe we should be paying attention to, and to prevent himself from being held accountable.
Well, back to the USA Today editorial. Trump has shown contempt for ethical strictures that have bound every president in recent memory. He has refused to release his tax return with the absurd excuse that it's because he's under audit. He has refused to put his multi-billion-dollar business interests in a blind trust and peddles the fiction that putting him in the hands of his sons does the same thing. Not to mention calling white supremacists very fine people, pardoning a lawless sheriff, firing a respected FBI director, and pushing the Justice Department to investigate his political foes. It is a shock that only 6 Democratic senators are calling for our unstable president to resign. And given that there are 56 women in the Congress, who wrote a letter to Chairman Trey Gowdy of the House Oversight Committee asking for an investigation into the complaints from at least 17 women of the 19 women who've accused Trump of sexual assault and sexual harassment. Obviously, Trey Gowdy, he conducted the Benghazi hearing. I wouldn't expect anything from him. But what's your sense, though? I mentioned earlier that while the bad guys may not be winning anymore, the good women seem to be stepping up. And I see that as a growing force. I mean, I know it manifests itself the day after Trump's inauguration, but I get the feeling now that there is a movement afoot, both in politics and in the broader society, that women are putting their foot down. They're not going to put up with it anymore.
I think that's right. I think there's more women running for office now. I think women are voting more deliberately, perhaps, than they did before. I have been impressed with the leadership that I've seen in the House and the Senate by women in power. I think that those are all good trends. I don't know if collectively the women will be able to stop Trump. And again, based on what we saw with Alabama voting patterns yesterday, where white women voted for Roy Moore, I don't know that it's all women in America that are wanting to stop Trump. But definitely there is an activated, determined coalition of women. It's something to see for sure.
Well, but if he's at 35%, that means there are 65% of people that are either not for him or who are on the fence. I mean, that's a lot to work with, isn't it? I mean, what I find extraordinary is the tyranny of the minority. This guy is a minority. He got elected with 3 million fewer votes than the person who won but didn't become the president by any other standard of the way the world conducts it. Democratic elections, and he's been able to really do an awful lot to change the entire politics, the economy, and just the sort of the health and welfare of this country, not to mention the world. He's been an absolutely zealous leader of a vicious kind of wrecking crew. So what I find extraordinary is that he's getting away with as much as he is getting away with it. I mean, it's so strange to me that you'd have this tyranny of the minority.
Yeah, well, he is fortunate, I suppose, that his party controls all the branches of government right now. I mean, I think that if there was any more serious opposition internally, then he wouldn't be as successful as he's been. And largely his success has been in the form of not staffing offices and positions and, sort of deregulating things or appointing people to head divisions who want to destroy those divisions. I mean, he's definitely done a lot to take what was an established, federal apparatus and minimize it. That's his plan. And again, I really can't stop thinking about him as an unaccountable leader. If you think about what regulations are, they are ways of holding people accountable. And so he, as a person, has refused that, has refused to be held accountable. And so he hates regulations. I suspect this is a guy who, won't wear a seatbelt. No matter how many times his car, ding, 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 ding. I bet he's a guy who won't put on his seatbelt. He cannot be told what to do. And he has used that as a strength in the 2016 election. He used that to his advantage, right? Every time he said, I'm not going to be told what to do by lobbyists. I'm not going to take money from people. I'm not going to have a teleprompter. He framed it as being, the champion of the voice of the people and that he was not corrupt and he couldn't be corrupted. But in fact, it's just his nature. He can't be controlled. And those are all things that would sort of seek to control him.
Well, I keep going back to the USA Today editorial because it's so extraordinarily powerful. If recent history is any guide, the unique awfulness of the Trump era in U.S. politics is only going to get worse. Trump's utter lack of morality, ethics, and simple humanity has been underscored during his 11 months in office. As of mid-November, he has made 1,628 misleading or false statements in 298 days in office. That's 5.5 false claims per day. So, just in closing, the expectation is it's going to get worse. Now, I think he'll either come out of the Oval Office in an orange jumpsuit or a straitjacket, because I can't see this. I think he's mentally disturbed. But what's your sense then of how much worse it could get? And does it have to get worse to get better? Or is there a breaking point when American people, I mean, I don't, you know, how do you get rid of this guy? I guess that's the inherent question.
It is the question, and it's the question of the USA Today's op-ed, right? Will Trump's lows ever hit rock bottom? What is rock bottom? How do you get rid of this guy? How do you hold him accountable? What is rock bottom? These are all questions that we can guess at, but no one can answer for sure. My sense from studying the guy is that the more he's trapped and the more he's put in a corner and the more people try to tell him not to do things, the more he lashes out. The more aggressive he gets, he sees himself as, fighting a righteous cause. And the people who support him also see that, right? They see the world through that frame. And so any attempt to, hold him accountable is going to result in people thinking that there is more corruption, that the system is rigged, that, you know, they're just out to get him. It's going to be really difficult to prove to people who are unwilling to see Trump for what he is, perhaps, to get them to see him that way. And I think that there was the same problem with Nixon. So when Ford pardoned Nixon without allowing the case to sort of stand trial, it allowed for a certain true believer in the Nixon presidency to believe that he had been framed, right? That he had been set up and that none of it was true. So there are people who believe that about Nixon, that Nixon was framed, that he was innocent, and that there was a conspiracy against him. It was never proven. And I believe that there are people who will also always believe that Trump was innocent, that he was really a good guy. He was fighting corruption, and the corrupt system won. So it's going to take some careful proving by the federal government, if the prosecution ever does mount a case against Trump, to really prove to those people who are Trump's fans, his true believers, his base, that he was in fact guilty all along, that he wasn't the heroic champion of the people that he promised he was.
Well, Jennifer Machia, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a third book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. We're going to take a brief station break and back exploring whether the political tide is turning in America and the bad guys are no longer winning as the good women in particular make a stand with a good guy like Doug Jones elected to the U.S. Senate.
What's in your head is really started showing. Your conversation's getting kind of boring. Don't believe nothing you say, 'cause I'm around and I see what you do. You know you're uglier than a mosquito's fleeter. You got a mouth like a herd of boll weavers. Same old game, same old game. Always rapping about the same old thing.
At least it's not the end of the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Rui Teixeira, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author or co-author of several books on American politics, including The Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judas. And his latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rui Teixeira.
Glad to be here again.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I called you because, you know, there was so much doom and gloom about the possibility of a child molester being elected to the United States Senate. And it does feel like ever since Donald Trump emerged as a candidate and then as a president of the United States, it's felt like the bad guys are winning, not just here in America, but around the world with Putin and Erdogan and Duterte and all these horrible people that are strutting their stuff on the world stage, as our president does. So what happened last night in Alabama could be a turning point. What do you think?
Well, I think it's an indicator of where we're going. I mean, it's not the reason why, for example, the Democrats will almost certainly do extremely well in 2018, but it's an indicator of where things are trending. And I think what we're finding out is that I think people were a little freaked out by Trump being elected and sort of thought he kind of, in a way, had the magic juju. I mean, even when you think the guy shouldn't be able to get over with something or, you know, he'll get over with it. Somehow he'll make it happen. He'll disappoint all our expectations. But I think what we're finding out is that an unpopular president and an unpopular party doing unpopular things and standing for unpopular values is unpopular. I mean, people will reject the Republican politics of the current day if it goes too far. And that's even the case in a place like Alabama, which, of course, is deep red and is not likely to go Democratic in a presidential election, at any rate, anytime soon, though I suppose you never know. But yeah, they just went too far. They're reaping the whirlwind of sort of unleashing all these dark forces within their party. And you know, sort of the chief dark force being the right there in the White House. So this is a bit of a problem for them. I mean, it's a funny thing to talk about a party that has problems when they could rightfully point out, well, we got the presidency, the Senate, the House, and most of the state legislatures. But, you know, politics does tend to be a bit cyclical, and it does tend to respond as well to long-run forces. And they're on the wrong side of both of those, both the cyclical forces and the long-run changes in American society. They're just like, you know, stamping their little feet and saying, you know, we don't want to change. We don't want to go where the country's going. And if you don't like it, screw you. And so, you know, they're getting a reply at this point from people in all kinds of unlikely areas of the country. I mean, it's not just Alabama. If you look at all the special elections that have been held since the 2016 election, of course, there was Virginia and New Jersey and so on, they're just, the Republicans are repeatedly and of large magnitude underperforming their previous outings. And it really looks very bad omens for them for 2018. Very bad indeed.
But as Democrats, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners, are taking comfort from the defeat of Donald Trump and most of all Stephen Bannon, who, that was a great concern that I shared with a lot of people, which was if Bannon's candidate won, Roy Moore, then he would continue being a credible figure in the Republican Party, at least a major kind of bomb thrower, an insurgent, not that his insurgency is over. But a lot of the sting,
no, not at all.
A lot of the sting has been taken out of it. But don't we have to sort of basically pull back a little bit and recognize that Roy Moore is possibly the worst possible candidate anybody could have run for any office, whereas the guy that he defeated in the primary, Luther Strange, would have definitely beaten Doug Jones.
I think that's fair to say. You know, after all, Moore, even with all this, only lost by a point and a half, 20,000 votes. So, yeah, you'd think a more normal candidate probably would have prevailed given the partisan leanings of Alabama at this point. I don't know if I'd go so far as one Republican operative who was quoted as saying, you know, we literally could have picked any name out of the phone book, and they could have won that election for us as a Republican. But we just happened to pick Roy Moore. That was unfortunate. So, yeah, no, I think it's important to point out, too, and I'm sure it's in the minds of a lot of your listeners, this is great. It's good. We're not totally going down the rabbit hole, but we're not out of the woods yet. And people who care about a different politics than what the current Republican Party represents have a lot of work to do between now and 2018 and 2020.
So what about the calculus then? And it goes back to Steve Bannon. He is causing heartburn in the Republican Party, probably less so now. And it's always made me absolutely mystified as to why, I mean, what makes this guy tick and why anybody takes him seriously. He chose Roy Moore. He's chosen Chemtrail Kelly in Arizona, Foster Freeze, who's a raving nutcase, and this convicted felon in upstate New York, Michael Grimm. I mean, what the hell's he thinking? And in fact, Mitch McConnell said that. He said this guy is great at picking losing candidates. But a lot of Democrats think, well, you know, this is good. Let the Republicans tear themselves apart. And these nutcases end up running as candidates. And after all, that's chalked up a victory in Alabama for the Democrats. So should we be hoping that Chemtrails Kelly gets the nod in Arizona?
Well, if you were thinking strategically, probably yes. I mean, I don't think you really want to go out on organizing for, but if your desire is to win that election, then it just makes sense that it would be better for your candidate if they faced the weakest possible other candidate, even though the possible harm that could be done by that terrible candidate being elected might be large. It's still, you know, if you want to win, you're better off with a crazy candidate. Now, of course, that's what we all thought when Donald Trump got the nomination. So, you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, oh, we can beat Trump.
Right.
Democrats only trouble doing that. Well, that turned out not to be true. So you got to be very careful about these things. And anyway, they're outside of, you know, the control of the left. What the left can do is run good candidates, run good campaigns, and, you know, be pretty militant. Try to take some of that populist mantle off of the Republicans who do run, which I think is really why Bannon still has cachet to some extent, that and the fact he was on Donald Trump's, was viewed as being, you know, Trump's Bengali and being somewhat responsible for him getting to where he did. I mean, that's what he still has in his back pocket. But in his view, he represents, Bannon thinks, he represents the populist wing of the Republican Party. And he believes that Donald Trump is being sold down the river by the establishment Republicans. And there's some truth to the idea. Trump has been completely captured by the, you know, standard center of gravity of today's very conservative Republican Party on economic and other issues. I mean, there's barely a populist plank left in his original platform. But I think where Bannon is wrong, and maybe where he'd even admit it if you pressed him, is that, you know, Trump could give a good gosh darn about all that populist stuff anyway, right? I mean, it was all rhetoric. So, but I think Bannon can still appeal and push candidates who appeal to that more populist, throw the bums out, you know, economic and political elites control everything and they don't care about the ordinary person type of voter.
Now, could the same logic, though, that applies to Bannon in the terms of wanting him to continue to his wrecking crew agenda, does that apply then to this hideous tax bill that's extremely unpopular that the Republicans are trying to push push through as fast as they can? Here in California, 11 of the 14 Republicans voted for it, and they could lose their seats as a result because it punishes California in this really petty, vindictive way that these Republicans have decided to go after the successful blue states and take away the tax deduction for state and local taxes, which effectively means that we'll be paying about 25% more tax in California as punishment for being a successful and progressive state. And by the way, we give more money to Mississippi and Alabama than we get back from the federal government. So is it better for this horrible bill to go through and then the Republicans suffer the blowback?
Well, I think this is similar to the debate about whether the Democrats would have been better off if Roy Moore won or Roy Moore lost. I mean, it was clear whether either one of these things happened, it would be bad for the Republican Party in any kind of medium-term sense. And probably the same thing is true of the tax bill. If they do pass it, yeah, it's pretty, I mean, it's a historically unpopular bill. All the polling data agree unanimously that this is one of the least popular pieces of major legislation the last couple of decades. And it's almost, you know, very unusual for something that's labeled, you know, pretty much labeled a tax cut to actually be extremely unpopular with voters. So this is quite an accomplishment. So if they do pass it, they will undoubtedly annoy a lot of voters, you know, including some that might even be potentially have been accessible to them on other grounds. It may increase turnout among, you know, already fired up Democrats who are pissed off about this bill. But, you know, if it's not passed, then, you know, that's potentially good for the Democrats, too. In terms of just raw political calculation, it takes the wind out of the Republican sails. They look even more ineffectual than they've already looked, and maybe it demoralizes the Republican base, which is pretty much their only hope for doing well in 2018 anyway. So, and that's leaving aside, I mean, one of the great advantages of defeating the tax bill is it's not all about politics. It's about the country. It's about governance. It's about people's lives. And this is a really crappy bill. And, you know, the country would be much better off if it never passes. Real harm will be done if it is. So at the end of the day, I'm willing to defeat the bill and take my chances, if that's possible. We'll see. I mean, they're obviously pushing it, trying to push it through as hard and as fast as they can. They don't want Doug Moore. They don't want Doug Jones to take a seat, which will complicate their calculus. So they want to get this done as fast as possible. But like I say, I think either way, there are problems for them politically.
Well, it is so flagrantly a bill designed to satisfy donors at the same time conning voters. I mean, and that gets to the broader issue about our politics in general as a result of Citizens United. That essentially has turned our politicians into telemarketers. You know, they spend almost all their day dialing for dollars. And Lindsey Graham has said, if we don't pass this tax bill, our donors have told us not to call us back and ask for money. So that's my hope, is that people see the raw nature of this horrible reality about our politics, that essentially at least the Republican Party and its leadership total hirelings of the plutocracy, and they're serving the plutocracy at the expense of the middle class.
Well, I do think it underscores it. I mean, the Democrats have their own dialing for dollars problem as a result of the way the campaign finance field has evolved. But in the Republican Party, they have a really toxic-looking confluence of sort of beliefs and interests between, on the one hand, what their donors clearly want, and on the other hand, you know, what Republicans pretty much believe is the party these days about taxes and growth and economics and the middle class. I mean, which is that at the end of the day, they don't have any other economic program that they all believe in other than taxes should be cut as much as possible, particularly for the so-called wealth creators. And in the end, everyone will be better off, which is not a popular point of view these days in America. I mean, very few people believe this outside of, you know, Republican Party politicians and a certain element of their own base, but not even all of their base, right? Because, you know, they have a lot of populist-oriented voters now who may hate, you know, not like the government and not like taxes, but they also really don't like giving money to rich people. So, yeah, well, let's hope this is a teachable moment, as they say.
Well, let's turn to the optimistic leftists, why the 21st century will be better than you think, this your new book, Rui Teixeira, and apply the optimism to the moment and where this may be heading. We've talked about the problems that the Republicans have with their tax bill and what a disaster it will be for average Americans, and particularly in the blue states, as I pointed out, where our taxes will be raised by 25%. There'll be blowback. And it seems that Trump is not going to change. If anything, he's going to get worse. And there are kind of two scenarios there. Either he'll be taken out of the Oval Office in an orange jumpsuit or in a straitjacket. But he, in the meantime, you know, the tweet that he did against Senator Gillibrand was just beyond belief, how disgusting it was. And yet you see the woman on the White House podium spinning the most insane lies and all of this.
That Sarah Huckabee Sanders?
Yeah, there's verbal gymnastics. It's breathtaking in the face of what this man is doing. So he's going to make things worse for the country, worse for the Republicans, and worse for the planet. And that's the trajectory he's on. How quickly can the Democrats, I mean, I guess we have to wait for 2018, and how optimistic can we be? It looks like the House is very much in play, and even now the Senate. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, you got all these dreadful judges that Trump and the Republicans are foisting on the bench. Two really bad ones have been rejected by Grassley, but one awful one has just slipped through. So how much damage can they do before 2018, do you think?
Well, you put your finger on one of the things that they can do and have done, which is appointing judges is a gift that keeps on giving in terms of some of their agenda. They're hard to get rid of once they're there, and it's something that, is relatively simple to accomplish, and once accomplished, serves your agenda. I think we've seen, on the other hand, that it's actually pretty hard for them to completely wreck the country as much as they said they would like, or at least their program implied. We've seen some weakening of regulations. We've seen them attempt to repeal Obamacare. That didn't work. We got this tax thing going now, which will be a problem for Obamacare, and as well for the tax structure. But I think we should think about this as not what they're doing isn't nearly as bad as what they could have done, and nothing they're doing is irreversible. Everything's reversible. And moreover, everything probably will be reversed once the Democrats get back into power, which is going to happen perhaps more quickly than we had hoped. I think the Democrats do look very good for 2018. I think, Trump runs an excellent chance of being a one-term president if he lasts long enough to run and win nomination and run in the general again. But I think one thing that's very important in terms of thinking about this optimistically, we shouldn't just think about the Democrats winning, though that is a necessary but not sufficient condition for where the country needs to go. But the Democratic Party itself is changing. The Democratic Party has become energized and clearly moved toward the left in terms of its economic program and economic approach than, say, 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, even Hillary was kind of left, but relatively speaking. But I think it's pretty easy to predict that whoever runs for the Democrats in 2020 and a lot of the Democratic candidates in 2018, they're going to be running very hard on a very different kind of economic program that actually might do the middle class in this country and the economy in general some real good. And I think that's, as I've argued in my book, the key to the future is getting on a different growth path that's solider, more productive, more widely shared, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, we know how to do this. The policies are available. They're pretty clear. I discuss them in my book. You've got many, many economists, including people who used to be looked with suspicion, on the left, like Larry Summers, basically calling for massive public investment. But that's really what we need to jolt the economy into the right direction. So I just think that the combination of the political cycle coming around for the Democrats and the Democratic Party itself changing in terms of its political and economic philosophy augurs pretty well for the early 2020s.
Well, just in the last minute, Rui Teixeira, it's pretty clear to me that Trump is angling and preparing to fire the special prosecutor, perhaps at the end of the year. They make this artificial deadline that he's supposed to wrap it up by the end of the year. The number one Trump whisperer is Rupert Murdoch, who runs Fox. He's obviously orchestrating a campaign where all the junkyard dogs on their pantheon of yapping propagandists, they're just absolutely going nuts against Mueller and making up all kinds of absolutely scurrilous, crazy attacks on him. So what's going to happen there, do you think? Will that provoke a constitutional crisis?
Geez, I don't know. That's sort of above my pay grade. My guess is somehow it'll all muddle through. I mean, it'll just do enormous political damage to Trump and the Republican Party. But whether it'll provoke a true constitutional crisis, like I say, I can't really pronounce on that. But, I don't see any. It's one of these. There are no good outcomes here for the Republicans. This is what happens when a party's in trouble. They're like, elections happen, issues come up. Things like the Mueller thing are ongoing, and there are no good outcomes. There are only less bad outcomes. So,
well, Rui Teixeira, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure, a pleasure as always.
And again, I've been speaking with Rui Teixeira, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author or co-author of several books on American politics, including The Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judas. His latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. We're going to take a brief station break. We will analyze whether the punishment of California in the Republican tax bill will backfire on California's Republican delegation.
Yeah, it seems like. Yeah, it feels like. Yeah, it seems like.
That lingers in your ear, but you can't forget from sundown to sunset. Nah, nah. It's all in the air, you hear it everywhere. No matter what you do, it's gonna grab a hold on you. California soul.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mark Sandelow, who's an associate academic. And joining us now is Mark Sandelow, who is associate academic director of the University of California Washington Center and editor-in-chief of the California News Service. Prior to his appointment, he spent 21 years with the San Francisco Chronicle, including 11 years as the paper's Washington bureau chief. He's the author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi's Lifetimes, and Rise to Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Sandelow.
Good to be here, Ian.
And it seems that in many ways, the Republican delegation to the House is in trouble. There are 14 members, and 11 of them have voted for the tax package, which is now in conference, which punishes California. I mean, there's no two ways about it. There's almost a deliberate piece of political vindictiveness here that the blue states are losing their ability to deduct state and local taxes, which means that every California's taxes might well go up between 20% and 25%. So this is really going to hurt these Republicans. Three of them voted against it in the first go-round in the House: Dana Rohrabacher, Darrell Issa, and Tom McClintock. What's your sense of whether in conference any of the other 11 are wavering?
So, I mean, Ian, I share your analysis of how this is terrible for California, and your cynicism about it being almost vindictive in general may be so, but I think it's important to point out that it's not as if people in the White House, which would be very easy for people to think right now, or in Congress, thought, well, let's see, what can we do to hurt California? But there is a piece, there's an element to, as they try to figure out how to cut taxes, and if you cut taxes in some places, you raise them in other, and there are, unlimited number of interests around, there certainly is not a large group of people saying, hey, wait a second, this will hurt California. That's where the problem is that, California, it's certainly not aimed at California, but California simply doesn't have the defenses in there. Now, it does seem like the group of lawmakers you're talking from, and, out of 53 representatives in the California delegation, only 14 are Republican. That's still a pretty solid block. It appears what's coming out of conference, at least reports, today, is that they got a bit of a compromise to try to help the California Republicans sell this politically. So the state and local taxes, which you mentioned, which are much higher in California, which can no longer be deducted, it sounds like the deal they have reached is that they will be able to deduct up to $10,000 of that. And what that means is for most middle-class Californians, that will offer considerable relief. Upper middle class Californians, that's still going to be a problem because local taxes amount to, when you add up your income tax and your property tax, add up to far more than $10,000. The other issue that affects California is the deduction of the interest on the home mortgage rate, something which only concerns people who buy houses, but everyone who owns a house knows what I'm talking about, and it saves you a fortune. Now, the bill that's apparently coming out of conference will say that interest deduction is limited to the first $750,000 of your mortgage, which sounds like a ton of money. Who can afford a house and have to borrow more than $750,000? Well, the answer is middle-class people in California, because California, the housing prices are so expensive that that's not a crazy amount of money. So there are a couple places this hits California, but it does appear that this conference committee is giving enough cover for the Republicans in California to vote for it and say they're not hurting their constituents.
But in the House Republican tax bill, if it becomes law, victims of hurricanes in Texas and Florida will be able to deduct their losses, but not so for victims of the California wildfire. So again, there does seem to be a double standard.
There does appear to be, and actually what I've just seen today is that indeed the wildfire deductions could be an enormous problem for California, except they won't take effect until next year, meaning that chances are the people whose sadly, houses are burning, this week or Northern California, the last month, are still likely to be able to take advantage of it. But yes, this is why political power is so important. And while whether you are a Democrat or Republican, it's clear that a Democratic majority tends to be better for California. Because, the tax bill has all these competing interests in it. I mean, why is it that the, oil industry gets this enormous tax break where some of the renewable energy companies don't? It's simply because their lobbyists have presented better arguments, given more money, whatever the case might be, and they protect them. And right now, protecting California Republicans is not the priority of the majority of Congress.
And Mark Sandler, going back to the controversial repeal bill of the Affordable Care Act, the so-called California Seven, who voted for repeal, were pretty much targeted by the Democrats, and that's Ed Royce, Mimi Waters, Dana Rohrabacher, Daryl Issa, and here in Los Angeles, Northern Los Angeles, Steve Knight, and Jeff Dunham, and David Valadao. Now, the Democrats in the last cycle did pretty well-funded campaigns against Knight, Issa, and Denham, and both Issa and Denham barely got reelected.
Right.
So what's your sense of, given the optimism that Democrats are feeling now after what happened in Alabama, and a sense that Donald Trump's becoming less and less popular and he's a lightning rod for Democratic enthusiasm, how do you see this thing shaping up in terms of both the California 7 and now I guess you could call it the California 11?
The path to a Democratic majority in the House and, speakership once again for Nancy Pelosi goes right through California for exactly the reason you just mentioned, because there are so many vulnerable members in California. Overall, the Democrats are going to need to pick up, I think it's what, 28 seats, maybe 29, in order to pick up the majority in the House of Representatives. But they see an opportunity of picking up, maybe a third of that in California alone. One of the reasons that Nancy Pelosi rose to the top of the Democratic Party in Congress and ultimately became Speaker is because she was so effective at raising money and helping fellow Californians. I mean, she has a very, very safe district up in California. There's a lot of wealthy folks in Northern California and very safe seats. Same is true in the Los Angeles area. She's been very effective at taking money out of those districts and pouring it into, more Central Valley districts or Inland Empire districts that are much more vulnerable. And I think that, California always gets left out of the presidential race because it's such a blue state that no one bothers to waste their money there. This is certainly going to be a record year in terms of spending in California.
But, for example, Daryl Issa, he was very aggressive for the longest time over all kinds of what seemed to be highly politically charged. I was trying to be polite, not use the word witch hunts, but they were hearings that were clearly political kangaroo courts. And but he's totally changed his tune now. He's voted in favor of the special counsel, which is certainly something that most of his Republican colleagues are against, the Mueller investigation, etc. Is that going to work? Can the leopard change its spots on a 2 or 4 year cycle?
Absolutely. And this gets into this tough issue. I mean, you can say, you know, what, I mean, you can present it as ISA doing nothing more than putting his finger to the wind and being a poll-driven politician who does whatever he can in a craven way to get reelected. That's one way to put it. Another way to look at it is this is how democracy works. I mean, the going after President Obama, which you point out he did, and then pulling the reins, you know, and then not acting quite the same toward Trump, but then sort of switching when you realize that your own constituents are going to punish you because Donald Trump plays so poorly in California. That's also, in a sense, the will of the voter being expressed. I mean, Daryl Issa understands that if he is going to play like a Republican in Alabama, he's not going to continue to serve in Congress anymore. And so he changes tunes. And you could say that that's simply the voters of California expressing their will, and it's being displayed in Washington.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, do you know anything about Devin Nunes? Because his antics as chair of the House Intelligence Committee have not exactly distinguished him as a great statesman.
I can't tell you about, you know, the process of his prospects for re-election. I can certainly tell you that he is viewed out here as an incredibly partisan player. I mean, that's one of the things that's been most disturbing about Washington recently. I mean, I always am telling people that the House of Cards view of Washington as dark and sinister is really overdone, that there are literally hundreds of thousands of people in this area who are here because they're trying to help advance causes that they care deeply about, whether those are conservative or liberal causes. They're not all in it for the money. But what's happened recently is, and Nunes is a perfect example of it, when an ethics line is crossed, it seems to matter what party that person belongs to as to whether or not they're gone after. And it's most ridiculous in these sexual assault cases where there just seems to be this patent hypocrisy that, to put it as bluntly as I can, it doesn't matter if it's a Democratic penis or a Republican penis. If you do something that is inappropriate, it's inappropriate, and penalties ought to be paid, and it ought to make no difference whatsoever. And the notion that simply because somebody from your own party has committed this act, maybe we should look at it in a different way. And I know that there are a lot of very righteous Democrats out there who say, how can people go after folks, you know, like Al Franken? I realize I'm straying from Devin Nunes a bit here, and not go after President Trump. And it's worth reminding people that, you know, when Bill Clinton was accused of things, it wasn't simply a prudish affair that people were saying, oh, come on, Americans are so uptight about these things. I mean, Bill Clinton, there was considerable evidence, had done things as governor of Arkansas that could only be called sexual harassment. People who liked his politics were more willing to overlook that. And that's certainly what's happening with Donald Trump right now. And Devin Nunes hasn't been involved in investigating the sexual matters, but certainly with the intelligence matters, if Barack Obama had leaked information to the Russians that came from Israeli intelligence, which Donald Trump did, or had questionable dealings with the Russians, he would have been, as you say, involved in the biggest witch hunt in history. But simply because that person's on the other side, that's not the way that's happening. And if I could pinpoint why people don't like Washington, that's why.
Well, Mark Sandilow, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Sandilow, who's the Associate Academic Director of the University of California Washington Center and Editor-in-Chief of the California News Service. Prior to his appointment, he spent 21 years with the San Francisco Chronicle, including 11 years as the paper's Washington Bureau Chief. And he is the author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi's Life, Times, and Rise to Power. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.